Unlock your Bible. Discover the true meaning of life. Learn the cause of world problems and the astounding solution. Prove for yourself what the future holds. In the Trumpet Literature Library, you will find answers to life's most important questions. Explore these vital titles on Trumpet Bookshelf.
Welcome to Trumpet Bookshelf. I'm Grant Turgeon. We're broadcasting to you live this morning from the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus here in Edmond, Oklahoma. I actually had a pretty good laugh there during the top of the hour news. Hadn't heard the term dotard in a while. That's one of those words that causes me to giggle right away. So thankfully, I was able to compose myself before this show started. Well, tomorrow is the 30-year anniversary of the start of the Philadelphia Church of God. December 7th, 1989 was when this church started. Earlier this year, Mr. Stephen Fleury signed my copy of his book, Raising the Ruins, and he wrote in there, "Grant, may you make this history your own. Much love, Stephen Fleury." This is something that probably applies to not only me, but most of you listeners too. The church is older than I am, and it's older than a lot of you probably too, or at least the history goes back farther than most of us have been around the church. And so we weren't necessarily there for a lot of the events depicted in the book Raising the Ruins. It is very helpful for us to go back because of that and understand more of what took place that would get us to this point where we're already 30 years in to the seventh and final church era. And of course, after that is the return of Jesus Christ. We have to understand this history. It's valuable history. Here in chapter 13, which is titled Breaking Ground, there's a subtitle, Moving Headquarters. And Mr. Stephen Fleury here is writing about how just a few years after Herbert W. Armstrong died, the Worldwide Church of God founder, they were already starting to shift the focus of the entire work. They wanted to shut down the Pasadena campus of God's College, the headquarters campus of the entire massive worldwide work that reached and changed the lives of millions of people. And they just wanted to go over to Big Sandy, Texas, and consolidate their operations there. Never mind that Mr. Armstrong had said probably dozens of times, "Don't do that. Don't consolidate on Big Sandy. Don't leave Pasadena." But also this closing of one campus in favor of the secondary campus really did signify a shift in priorities in the work. Matthew 24, verse 14 talks about how Mr. Armstrong actually fulfilled this prophecy of preaching the gospel around the world. And he definitely did. He met with hundreds of world leaders. And he spoke to them in language that they could understand. He wasn't trying to baptize all of them or convert all of them. He wasn't on a soul-saving crusade. He was just trying to give them hope. Maybe give them a little bit more understanding of a peaceful future, which obviously is very far away from what the world is experiencing right now. But it wasn't very long after Mr. Armstrong died that the commission of the work changed. It went from Matthew 24, verse 14, which again is focused on giving to the entire world, to Matthew 28, verse 19, which focuses on baptizing as many people as possible. And that did apply a lot more back in Christ's day. But you can see how going from a worldwide focus, warning the world with urgency before horrible events come to pass, to then just going back to trying to increase church membership really is just a step backward. It's about trying to get. It's reminiscent of the mission of most traditional Christian churches. Like I said, soul-saving crusades. Because they believe that in this life, right now, God and Satan are fighting to save as many people as they can. They believe that this is the only day of salvation. But when you learn the truth about the three resurrections, you begin to understand that that's not the case at all. God has perfect timing. He decides when to call people. There are those he calls today. There are those he will call after Christ has already returned. And there are even more who 1,000 years after Christ returns will be resurrected from the dead, and they'll have a chance to learn too. Obviously, if God were trying to save as many people as possible right now, you could easily admit it's not going very well. It doesn't seem like many people even try to obey God today. So obviously, this soul-saving crusade, this competition between God and Satan, if it even was a competition, would be won handily by Satan. That's the kind of focus that the Worldwide Church of God after Mr. Armstrong developed. Let us just try to increase membership. Let us try to turn the focus inward, gain more followers, try to save people now, because really they stopped understanding the truth about the different resurrections and the different timings for people to be saved. Mr. Tkach, around that time when he was moving the campus, the headquarters, from Pasadena to Big Sandy, actually said, Big Sandy has served as a second headquarters for decades. As Mr. Fleury points out in Raising the Ruins, that's not true. It was a second campus for the college, but certainly not a second headquarters. And as we'll learn, even the physical headquarters campus is not nearly as important as the people or the person God is using. Mr. Armstrong was vastly different from what his successors said. They thought that it was important to build up the college. He said the whole purpose for the college is to support God's work. The college only exists because it expands the scope and the impact of God's warning message. And as soon as it stops serving that purpose, the college would be better off shut down. Again, all of this took place within a few years after Mr. Armstrong died. They changed the entire mission of the church so quickly. Here's what Mr. Stephen Fleury writes in Raising the Ruins, right at the end of chapter 13. What I find most remarkable about this history is that the very day Mr. Tkach broke ground on a new headquarters in Big Sandy, the church's headquarters actually did move, but not to Big Sandy. On December 7th, 1989, the real groundbreaking ceremony took place in Pasadena, California, inside Joseph Tkach Jr.'s office. On that day, Tkach Jr. fired my father and John Amos. That's the day headquarters moved from Pasadena, California to Edmond, Oklahoma. And you could see what he's referring to there with the different headquarters campuses. There was no actual headquarters campus in Edmond, Oklahoma, but that's where God's Man was based. That's where Mr. Gerald Fleury was based. If you look at the word for church in the Bible, it's translated from a Greek word, ekklesia. It's talking about a group of people, like a family or a team. So the church headquarters moved to a new group of people. Wherever God's Man is wherever headquarters is. Mr. Armstrong said that at the end of his life, too. When he had to move to Tucson, Arizona, that became the de facto headquarters of the work. Same thing here. When Mr. Fleury was fired and God stopped working through the Worldwide Church of God, the headquarters became wherever Mr. Fleury is. And no, there wasn't a big campus in Edmond. There weren't a lot of impressive buildings and lovely landscaping out here like there is now. And yet, the headquarters was still moved here. As Mr. Gerald Fleury writes in the Habakkuk booklet, and as the Habakkuk book itself in the Bible talks about, there was a wicked one fighting against a righteous one in a court case. Now, this took place 7 years after Mr. Fleury was fired. But you could think of this December 7th meeting, which lasted for 4 hours. This one firing meeting took 4 hours, but this is like the first clash between the wicked one and the righteous one. Mr. Takach Jr., not even Mr. Takach, the pastor general of the church, but Mr. Takach Jr. called Mr. Flurry and Mr. Amos and told them to fly out to Pasadena that very day, December 7th. And this meeting lasted all evening. Mr. Stephen Flurry writes in Raising the Ruins here, this is the first part of chapter 14, first sip of a bitter cup. Suffice it to say, there was no compromise on either side that night. Shortly before midnight, Joseph Takach Jr., a man who had been employed by the church for 3 years, fired and excommunicated my father and John Amos. At his deposition, Takach Jr. acknowledged that it was entirely his decision to fire these two longtime ministers on the spot. His father, the pastor general of the church, was not aware of the firings until after they had already happened. Upon leaving Takach Jr.'s office that night, my father prophetically warned Takach, "This is the first sip of a very bitter cup you are going to have to drink." And it's really important here to note that Mr. Flurry and Mr. Amos did not have a government problem. They were not going around Oklahoma in their congregations trashing the men who had replaced Mr. Armstrong. They actually, at the time, genuinely believed that God would get the church back on track through their productive conversation with Mr. Takach. But instead, they didn't even get to speak with him. They had to speak with his son. And they were brought out to Pasadena just to be fired. That was preordained. It didn't matter what took place in that meeting. They were as good as gone already. It's really disappointing that the church could make that many changes so quickly, continue to lie to the membership for a good 5-10 years after this even, about what the mission of the work was, and keep on taking the tithes and offerings of these people while completely going against everything those people would have wanted to support. They just lied and lied and lied, and there was nothing that anybody could have ever told them to get them off of that bad track. Here is what Mr. Takach Jr. said several times about Mr. Flurry and about what Mr. Flurry said during that firing meeting. He claimed that he was being used by God in a unique way, different from any other human ever to have lived. This is what he said several times during the court case between the WCG and the PCG in the fight for Mr. Armstrong's writings. Now, this is a common theme. This is something that you see repeatedly from critics of God's work. They always make assertions without a shred of evidence. You could never prove or disprove if Mr. Flurry had ever said anything like that. In the book of Colossians, the Colossians booklet that Mr. Gerald Flurry wrote, he talks about how the leadership after Mr. Armstrong claimed that Mr. Armstrong gave a deathbed repentance. So right before Mr. Armstrong died, apparently he spoke to Joseph Takach, and he renounced everything he had ever taught his entire life. This conversation wasn't recorded. There was no one else there. It was just one man's word saying that Mr. Armstrong completely disavowed everything he had ever taught. And as Mr. Flurry points out in that Colossians booklet, it is satanic to make claims like that that can never be proven. That's not how God works. He does not just allow one person to make an assertion or a claim like that and then expect everyone else to just take his word for it. There has to be proof. There has to be evidence. You have to be able to back up what you say with actual facts. But this is what has always been done the last 30 years. There have always been critics of the work who make outrageous claims, personal attacks against God's men. Never any evidence shown. And it's just an absolutely despicable tactic to make people question those leaders. And you'll notice they don't attack any of the doctrines. They have no chance of disproving any of those. So they attack the man. Now, all of us are imperfect. If you really wanted to, you could find fault with absolutely anyone who has ever lived. That doesn't really mean much when you're talking about a message from God, though. If God is using a man, he can use a very imperfect man anyway to do the work. Here's just some more proof that Mr. Fleury and Mr. Amos, before they were fired, were not undermining church government in any way. They weren't creating doubt in their members. They were presiding over the Oklahoma City and Enid congregations here in Oklahoma. And the man who was sent to Oklahoma City to inform the congregations that Mr. Fleury and Mr. Amos were fired said that the brethren were totally shocked by the news. He said, most had no idea anything of this nature was going on. So this just shows Mr. Fleury's congregations were left in stable condition. He was not trying to poach members from the Worldwide Church of God. He was not trying to cause doubt and confusion in their minds. The worst things they ever said were maybe something about Mr. Armstrong's literature being dropped from circulation, or maybe a change in direction on the World Tomorrow telecast. Another thing that they were supposedly fired for is for actually recommending literature that Mr. Armstrong wrote to the members. Imagine that, like Mr. Stephen Fleury writes here. Recommending members read Mr. Armstrong's most important and effective book, Mystery of the Ages. Ministers in that church recommending literature written by the physical head of that church, and that was partial cause for them getting fired. Absolutely outrageous. And I just find this next part of chapter 14 of Raising the Ruins hilarious. This is titled Ralph Helge's First Sip. So this was someone working for the WCG, and he was sending messages back and forth to Mr. Fleury, trying to negotiate some exchange of items here. He said here basically that the WCG has no obligation to pay you any severance, but as a matter of Christian love, the employer is desirous of helping you now that your employment with the employer has ended. So he actually offered Mr. Fleury a payment of $6,160, but Mr. Fleury had to agree to five conditions. For example, as Mr. Stephen Fleury writes here, the WCG wanted written release from any and all possible liability like wrongful termination. They also expected him to return church stationery and business cards, ministerial manuals, his ordination certificate, all church equipment and furniture, and any written or computer-generated records that pertain to church membership. And so they went back and forth, and Mr. Fleury wouldn't agree to any of this. Eventually, they even offered him a computer in exchange for the computer that he already had, but no longer were they offering that money anyway. So suffice it to say that there was no compromise there either on the exchange. Now, like Mr. Stephen Fleury points out here, it is interesting looking back that Mr. Tkach Sr. never once communicated with my dad during this whole ordeal. For the most part, Tkach Jr. and Helge handled the situation. And 7 years later, when the WCG filed suit against us over printing Mystery of the Ages, Tkach Sr. would again be missing from the equation, having died of cancer in 1995. The two principal players, without question, in the case brought against us in 1997 were Joseph Tkach Jr. and Ralph Helge. So you can see Joseph Tkach was appointed pastor general for after Mr. Armstrong died, but he was never really in charge. He always had these people around him, these fellows around him, who were truly the ones making the decisions. The rest of this chapter here talks about the beginning of a new work, and how December 16th, just a week after Mr. Fleury and Mr. Amos were fired, they had their first Sabbath services. There were 12 people total, so a couple other families expressed support. They all attended Sabbath services together. December 20th, the PCG became an incorporated entity, which it's funny because Mr. Stephen Fleury says how he was shocked that they were already considering themselves an official church when they were so small. But that's something we all have to learn, right? How God always starts really small. Right here at the end, he talks about how when they were printing Malachi's message and they were going to send out about 1,000 copies to people in Oklahoma and Ohio, people they had addresses for who had had contact with the WCG, Mr. Fleury also wrote a personal letter to his Oklahoma City and Enid brethren, to those congregations, just to put inside of Malachi's message for them to read. And he just has to dispel some of these rumors, some of these blatant lies told about him. Here are some of the things, again, that Mr. Joseph Tkach Jr. said about Mr. Gerald Fleury. He says that Mr. Fleury said that he could run the work better than Mr. Tkach does. He says that Mr. Fleury said, "Shut up and listen to me." Another accusation was that every time Mr. Fleury sent in magazine articles, he demanded that they had to be printed because people must read what he had to say. Mr. Fleury writes in this letter, Mr. Gerald Fleury, "The truth is, I haven't submitted an article in about 6 or 7 years, and I have never demanded that any articles be printed. Why should this even be mentioned now after such a long time? What is the motive?" And again, this just proves how rare it is that critics actually try to disprove any doctrines. And even when they actually do address doctrinal questions, they offer no alternative. They say, "Well, we know the PCG is wrong, but we don't know what's right, actually. We're confused about that part of it." What about Matthew 16, verse 18? It says that Christ builds his one true church. There's one church built on the foundation of Christ. It doesn't say there's 20,000 churches. So where is the one true church? They never try to address that. All the critics over the last 30 years have never tried to address that. But they keep on lying. I mean, these are just outrageous claims that Mr. Tkach Jr. made. If you know anything about Mr. Fleury, you could never imagine him saying to anybody, "Shut up and listen to me." He's never even told me that in all the times he's corrected me, and I'm his own grandson. You'd think if he would tell it to anybody, I'd probably be a likely candidate for that. But anyway, a bunch of lies going on here. A little bit farther down in this letter to his former congregations in the WCG, Mr. Fleury writes, "The Oklahoma City and Enid churches went through terrible turmoil in the 1970s, more than most churches. I desperately wanted to avoid causing you any more problems, but trouble now could mean far less difficulty in the future. I hope that serving almost 5 years in this area has revealed my love for all of you. The decision to take a stand on the issues presented in the message of Malachi was not taken lightly. Mr. John Amos and I have given up almost all physical security we had, almost any physical security we had. It's hard on our whole families. As you know, my wife has had serious heart problems for years. Why would we decide to take such a stand?" How can you answer that? How can you possibly say that he would want to do this on a human level, that this would be his first option physically? I actually spoke to Mr. Fleury this morning about that four-hour meeting, and he said that the whole thing revolved around Malachi's message. Now, the manuscript back then wasn't even finished yet. They hadn't even read it, obviously, but Mr. Fleury told them, "Look, when I'm done, you'll be the first ones to receive a copy. I want you to read it. I want you to try to address what I say here and see if it's God's truth or not. This thunderous new revelation, go ahead and prove it wrong. But stop attacking me. Stop trying to get the focus back on attacking a man instead of focusing on the message. Mr. Fleury said to me this morning, they were already telling a lot of lies at that point, so it wasn't a big deal to tell a few more. They didn't care if they were going to slander somebody because they'd already been lying to the entire church about changing everything. Mr. Fleury says here a little bit farther along here in this letter to his former congregations, hopefully no one will think I'm doing this for money. The church offered me $6,000 assistance or severance pay if I met several conditions and also took my only car. I don't have a second car. I do not qualify to receive Social Security or unemployment compensation. Headquarters called the $6,000 a love offering. That view was not shared by me, so the money was rejected. And then right here toward the end, he says, I believe Mr. Amos and I would die if we had to for what is written in the message of Malachi. And for that reason, that will be the next book we get into on this program. So thanks so much for listening today. I'm Grant Turgeon. This has been Trumpet Bookshelf.
You've been listening to Trumpet Bookshelf. Please email your thoughts to comments at kpcg.fm. Listen for new episodes every Friday at 10 a.m. Central Time.